All right, y'all, welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm writing a blog entry. Well, I'm more copying and pasting things. Elements of a blog entry. Yes, that's right, I have a blog. I hardly ever write on it, but it does exist. ScottHorton.org/stress. It's named after, well, you know, my state of mind. And also, as kind of a homage, a homage to Bill Hicks. That's his first band. It was, which was kind of a homage to homage. I don't know how you're supposed to say it in which circumstance. To Kiss. His band was Stress. So, that's the name of my blog. Anyway, yeah, I'm posting an entry there right now. I'm also posting it at liberty.me, and I got news along those lines. The Scott Horton Show, I guess just the interviews. Why just the interviews? Don't y'all like it when I yell and scream at you too? Anyway, just the interviews. They'll all be running at liberty.me. They've got a podcast thing up where they're trying to put, I don't know, every libertarian podcast in the world on there or something? I don't know. A lot. And doesn't really look like I see any of my interviews up there yet, but they got my logo up there now. Let's see if I can find an address for you here. It would be liberty.me/studio. That's pretty simple. liberty.me/studio. And there's my logo, but then when I click on it, nothing really happens. It's got a bio. I don't see a list of shows or anything. Anyway, I don't know. I guess we're working on it. Yeah, see, I click on somebody else's. They've got a couple to play there. Anyway, that's cool. I got the same sort of thing going on over at Voices of Liberty, too. That's what grew out of the Ron Paul channel. And they're running my interviews there, and I talked with them recently, and it looks like we're probably going to be increasing my participation in what they're doing over there. I guess we'll see how it goes. But that's Voices of Liberty. Ron Paul's gig. Oh, yeah. See if I can get Ron on the show. It's been, I think, probably more than a year since I've interviewed Ron Paul. Now, what the hell is up with that? That's not good. I have Ron back on the show. Hey, today's show is going to be a good one. Whether the archives of it end up running at Voices of Liberty or liberty.me, I don't know. But it's going to be good anyway. Dennis Edney is going to be on the show. Dennis Edney is Omar Khadr's lawyer. I thought I had Omar Khadr's lawyer on the show, but there was a confusion about whose name is whose. Anyway, Dennis Edney. Well, I had it straight by the time I introduced the guy. I didn't screw it up that bad. Dennis Edney, he's Omar Khadr's lawyer. Who's Omar Khadr? Why, he's a child that George W. Bush tortured. Yeah, you'll like to know more about that. Dennis Edney coming up on the show. And Mike Meharry, also from the 10th Amendment Center. Boy, I better find this email. I got an email from the 10th Amendment Center the other day. That was really great. Thought I had it open, but it was numerous examples of the states nullifying and interposing themselves between the citizens and the national government of the United States. It was really something else. It was one of those things where, wow, you don't say, huh? And it's not just medical pot. It's all kinds of stuff. Boy, I sure hope I can find that email. Oh, yeah, I was supposed to answer that guy's email, too. I'm pretty bad about answering emails nowadays, so if I don't email you, don't take it personally. Maybe just email me again and say, hey, did you forget to answer me? Because, yeah, here we go. Here's something from Off Now. Nope, that's not what I'm looking for, though. Well, that's what commercial breaks are for, I guess. Digging through the email. Anyway, point is, I got a thing from the 10th Amendment Center, and it was a long list of new state laws that are you know, that count really considerable. You know, I don't know, swings against the evil Leviathan something. Yeah, fighting back against the central state with smaller central states. It's a strategy. Anyway, Mike Meharry from the 10th Amendment Center will be on to talk about that. By the way, it was funny yesterday. I got a few different emails saying they really liked my measles rant. So I thought, huh, I should go back and listen. I never go back and listen to the show anymore. So I went back and listened to it. And I realized just how funny it sounds, the introduction coming in from every break on the archives. Because on the archives, all of the music is minused out, right? Because who needs the trouble? So it's the music minus version that goes out in the archives. And I realize that there are people who don't understand that there's bumper music, who don't understand why I stop all the time, because they don't understand that it's a live show. These are the archives of a live show, you know? So all they hear is me saying, hey, everybody, welcome to the show. And then you, me, and everybody else are sitting here jamming out to the Beastie Boys or something for a minute. But they're sitting there wondering, why all the dead air, Horton? That's kind of funny. I could see why you wonder that. It's because the live audience is hearing music. And I'm hearing music at the time it's being recorded. That's the answer to your puzzlement. All right, so yeah, I said who's going to be on the show today. Sure hope I can find that email about the 10th Amendment Center. I wanted to say one more thing about the Voice of Liberty and Liberty.me thing. And that is that soon I'm going to have my own channel on Roku. And right now, the Liberty Radio Network already does. So you can hear this show, archives of the full show, the Liberty Radio Network version of it, on Roku right now, if you have a Roku. But I'm going to get my own channel on there because I would like to have my own channel on there. So that's not done yet, but soon. And also soon, get your wallet ready. Very soon, we're going to be starting a Kickstarter, finally getting this thing going, to raise enough money. Well, I'm going to have two different ones, really, but first, the first one is going to be to raise enough money to get this super genius guy to go through the 10 steps necessary, really, to get it all set, to get all of my 3,600-something interviews uploaded to YouTube, which should be good for helping get them out there more and better, I hope. So that's the main thing. Well, that's a main thing. And then the second main thing is that, I'm going to have another Kickstarter after that for, I need new servers. I've got volunteer donated servers of my own rather than like paying Rackspace or GoDaddy or whatever kind of crap, right? I have my own servers, but they're old and junky and falling apart and I need more and better ones. So says my genius guy, my other genius guy. I've got a few different genius guys. And anyway, the server-keeping genius guy says, man, you're going to have to spend a grand or two here on some new equipment here coming up right now. Oops. Ooh, which reminds me, I owe him bandwidth money. Anyway, so get ready for that. There's some Scott Horton Show fundraisers coming up. Never mind all the money that you guys should be donating to me all day, every day. The money you should be spending at Amazon.com by way of my link. The money you should be spending at my advertisers to let them know how much you love the show. All that, too. But now I'm just talking about the extra stuff that I'm going to be asking of you here coming up. I'm running a Kickstarter for... Can't wait. I think that's going to be cool, right? To have the 3,600 interviews all uploaded in order to YouTube. And then all the future ones, too. I think. I hope. That's the plan. Anyway, working on it. Trying to improve the show for you here as we... roll into year 8 of anti-war radio, basically. Yeah. Important things. DPRK, Iran, ISIS, etc. on the other side of this. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys. I hadn't got a chance to finish it yet. I only just saw it. Eric sent me this at at salon.com by Michael Lind. Libertarians hijacked the right. How free market zealots doomed American conservatism. You barely get past the title. I know it's self-explanatorily silly just with the title, but, you know, Michael Lind, he's no dummy. He's just wrong about everything. So he's wrong, but he's got some information. It'll be worth a read later on. Anyway, Michael Lind, by the way, if you go to antiwar.com and search for neocons, you'll find a million things by Justin. But the first thing you'll find is how the neoconservatives conquered Washington and launched a war by Michael Lind. It's the best thing he ever wrote. He wrote it for antiwar.com back in 2003, right as Baghdad was falling, basically. I believe, spring of 03. How the neoconservatives conquered Washington and launched a war. Read that if you hadn't before. I think you'll like it. Okay, good. All right, the news. Check this out. The Obamas, the Democrats, the way the Washington Post puts it, have been secretly discussing with North Korea having some talks. They've been having talks about talks. They've been having talks toward the having of talks. Let's meet and talk about whether we should have some talks. And what we might talk about at those talks, if we have some talks. Perfect. Beautiful. And, I'm sorry. I screwed up, man. I started reading this, and I did not get a chance to finish it. I just got a little sidetracked. And I didn't get back to it. But I did read the very beginning of this thing at Asia Times. Candid talks with North Korean officials. And then it's by Joseph R. Detrani. And, yeah, I got to go down to the bottom. It says here he's president of the Intelligence and National Security Alliance, a nonprofit think tank type thing, former special envoy for the six-party talks, and the ODNI. I'm starting in the middle of something there. So he's not working for he's participating in the talks as an experienced guy, but he's in this article, he says he's not representing the government. In the talks, I guess he is, though. Anyway, so what he says is the proposal from the North is you guys suspend your military exercises and we'll suspend our nuclear tests. Deal. Shake hands right now. Deal. We don't need to practice having war with you at all right now. Let's stop. And we don't need any more nuclear tests because they've had two very probable fizzles. And they've had a third nuclear test, which I don't think anybody ever really determined with any level of confidence exactly how successful they were or not. It was hidden deep enough underground that they weren't able to really detect it. At least that was the initial reports, and maybe I never did find out if anybody ever found out any more than that. But anyway, I think it's kind of a safe assumption that the third one was a fizzle, too. Now, it's possible they have enough weapons-grade uranium now that they could make a big bomb that they wouldn't be able to deliver, probably. But they could at least make a uranium bomb that would be easy enough to detonate. So if that's what they tested, then it probably was a success. But as far as making a plutonium bomb, that pretty much means, and there's kind of an asterisk on that, but that pretty freaking much means that it has to be an implosion bomb. And if it has to be an implosion bomb, then that's much more difficult to get to work right, hence the fizzles that they had on their first two tries. And so raise your hand if you are for the DPRK perfecting implosion technology. Right, I know, me neither. If there ever is a war and they launch nukes somehow at South Korea, wouldn't you prefer those nukes fizzle rather than actually detonate? Don't you prefer fizzle to fission? Me too. So here's what I propose. Talk with the North Koreans, for Christ's sake. I got a better idea. Drop all sanctions and send Henry Kissinger over there to shake hands and make friends. I mean that in a not murder every Laotian way, but in a shake hands with Mao Zedong way. I know Henry Kissinger, he's got a pretty black record. Not everybody will know what you mean by that if you say it that way. Send Madeleine Albright over there. Shake hands, make deals. We had a perfectly good deal with the North Koreans. It was called the Agreed Framework. And it was Warren Christopher back in 1994 under Bill Clinton. And look, I'm a libertarian. I don't think the U.S. government should exist, much less, you know, have access to anyone's tax revenue to spend on anything. You've got no quibble with me there or anything like that. But I'm just saying, all things being equal, bribing the North Koreans to not make nuclear bombs with pennies, basically, with a pittance, is worth doing. But of course, the George Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, completely ruined everything. You know, Clinton never lived up to the American side of the deal. He never gave him all the money he promised him. I guess he gave him some money, but very little. And then, if I remember right, they never even gave him the fuel oil at all. And Donald Rumsfeld's company, I think, got the money, but they never delivered a light water reactor and built a light water reactor in North Korea. The Americans never lived up to their end of the deal. They just said, oh, yeah, we're going to get to that. Yeah, we're going to get to that. Yeah, we're going to get to that. But the North Koreans still stayed within the deal. It was only after 2002 and early 2003 when the Bush administration made up a story. There's no proof for, no real reason to believe is true at all, that the North Korean ambassador just bragged for no reason and spilled the secret that they had a secret uranium enrichment program. There's no reason to believe they have a uranium program now, but there's no reason to believe it existed back in 2002 and that they were in violation of the agreed framework. But even if they were, still, blam, send some negotiators back over there and assuming that that leak was true, and let's see what we got to do to get them to halt that uranium production program then. Huh? Nope. Bush and Bolton and all them all heady, ready to invade Iraq and threaten everybody else. Announced new sanctions, announced that America was withdrawing and repudiating the agreed framework. And they also announced the creation of something called the Proliferation Security Initiative, which is a brand new ad hoc unilateral policy, declared policy to seize ships on the high seas, any North Korean ship that they felt like. And then I guess it was the more sanctions. There was one more thing. The sanctions are pretty heavy. There's one more thing I forget. In the spring of 2003, was the final straw that convinced the North Koreans to withdraw from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, kick the inspectors out of the country, and then begin to produce nuclear weapons technology. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Live, weekdays, noon to 2 Eastern Time on the Liberty Radio Network. Our first guest today is Dennis Edney. He is a lawyer, a Canadian lawyer, representing Omar Khadr, former Guantanamo inmate Omar Khadr. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Dennis?
I'm fine, thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us on the show today. Very important subject here. The website is freeomar.ca, freeomar.ca, and we have two 10-minute segments with a break in the middle here, so should be plenty of time. If you could please, sir, can you tell us just first of all, who is this kid? How is it that he ended up in the custody of the American terror warriors?
Well, he was the only child in Guantanamo Bay, and he ended up there because his father had come to Pakistan and then had left Canada to go to Pakistan and then Afghanistan to work as an engineer. And when Afghanistan was invaded by the United States, the country, of course, was in turmoil, and many people sought safety in the mountain regions of Pakistan, including the Kader family. However, Omar Kader's father abandoned him and left him in the hands of a small group of Taliban warriors, promising to return and pick him up, and never did. And Omar was 15 at the time.
15 years old. And this is right at the beginning of the war in 2001. And so then what happened?
Well, the compound he was in was attacked by the U.S. forces. It was bombed and reduced to rubble. Omar was the sole survivor. And when the dust settled, a Delta Force soldier, going by the pseudonym OC-1, stated he saw Omar crouched on his knees facing a blank wall, screaming from the bombing and shrapnel that had just permanently blinded him in one eye and had caused all kinds of damage to him. And then the officer shot Omar twice in the back. Omar was not expected to live. He regained consciousness 3 days later at the U.S. Naval Base in Bagram, Afghanistan. And from that moment, Scott, little did Omar realize that his life had changed forever. He suffered extensive horrors of abuse and torture in Bagram, and whatever happened to him in Bagram continued in Afghanistan, in Guantanamo.
All right. Well, I guess let's take it chronologically here, just for ease sake.
Sure.
Back to the battle. I guess there's a documentary about this. You Don't Like the Truth, which people can find at scotthorton.org/documentaries. I have it embedded in there for you. You Don't Like the Truth. The story of Omar Kader. And I can't remember if it's from that or what I've read in other times, but I seem to remember that the shooting where he was shot in the back, as you describe, that was early or kind of maybe midway through the firefight, and that he was found basically, as you say, it was assumed that he would die. He had been found in a pile of rubble from the battle, and this seems like it would contradict the charges against him, which actually sound a lot more like a scene from an old episode of the A-Team or something than something that could have actually fit with the circumstances of what we really know happened at that firefight. So in a sense, we're skipping ahead to the charges, but the charges are based on what they claim he did there. And I just wonder whether they're, you know, I know you're his lawyer, but can you tell us that story? Can you concede any part of what they accuse him of doing there?
They accused him of throwing a hand grenade that killed a Delta Force soldier called Christopher Spear. And Christopher Spear's team leader, for lack of a better description, who went by the pseudonym OC-1, gave evidence at the so-called Guantanamo trial in the military commissions. And he didn't see Omar do anything. And what he did talk about was that he saw Omar was not part of the battle and was screaming, as you say. And that when he had shot Omar and left this alleyway, there were other soldiers, not regular soldiers, who were following behind him, and hand grenades were being thrown all over the bloody place. And he never, ever, he's the only eyewitness to Omar Kader, and he can't point out that Omar Kader threw a hand grenade. In fact, what he did say was that after leaving Omar, having shot him twice in the back, the hand grenade came soaring over him. and he felt that, and he believed there was another person alive at that time. But if you consider the reality of it all, having shot someone twice in the back and leaving them for dead, it's highly likely, if not impossible, that that young boy was able to get up and throw a hand grenade, which, and certainly in the distance that would have been required. Mm-hmm. And so it was a fabrication.
Well, and who said he threw it?
Pardon?
It sounds like you're saying the state's witness is debunking their case against him. But who claimed that he actually threw the grenade?
He did that.
So who said that he did throw it, though?
Ah, well, that's the best part. I don't know if I should use that phrase, the best part. When from the moment Omar gained consciousness, he was interrogated by a military officer called Sergeant Claus. And Sergeant Claus, from the moment Omar gained consciousness, tortured him to acknowledge that he had thrown a hand grenade that killed Christopher Speer, and under torture, Omar, of course, admitted to that, as one would admit to anything. And Claus is a particularly interesting guy because he was convicted for having killed two detainees in Bagram using the torture techniques that he used on Omar and crippling two others. And Claus was then charged and it was deemed that he was charged and given a 6-month sentence for assaulting these people that he had killed. And Claus gave evidence that was harsher on this 15-year-old boy than he was on with adults. And so it was under torture by this horrible man who... He interrogated Omar 32 times in Bagram Hospital, including hanging him from the door, being able to stand on his toes, all kinds of humiliating treatment. In fact, you know, a former U.S. Army medic gave evidence that he found Omar chained to the door frame of a 5-foot-square wire cage with his arms suspended above his shoulders, hooded and weeping. And so that's the nature of the evidence that was provided about Omar Khadr.
That's all they had on him was his,
that's all they had on him.
His self-incrimination under torture. Which, you know, that's why the Fifth Amendment is the Fifth Amendment here in the United States. For just those kinds of things. But anyway, I think it's maybe it's just trivia at this point, because if he did throw the grenade like they claim from his tortured testimony, then I wonder, Dennis, whether you've ever heard of any international law that would make that a war crime for a civilian to defend himself from an invading military force by throwing a grenade at them. What the hell is a war crime about that? I mean, obviously what they did to him from that moment on is all war crimes, but we'll get back to that in a second.
Well, I remember the...
Oh, no, and now the music's playing. You know what? I'm sorry. I'm terrible at this. Hard break. We got to take a break. We'll be right back, and I'll let you get to that about the charges against him, the allegation of the thing that he didn't do, or whether that would be a war crime anyway, and then we'll get back to efforts to free him and the rest. It's Dennis Edney. He's the lawyer for Omar Khadr, innocent victim of the American Empire. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. It's my show, Scott Horton Show, here. I'm talking with Dennis Edney. He's a lawyer representing Omar Khadr, Canadian citizen. At 15 years old, his father abandoned him with some Taliban fighters. They were attacked by the Delta Force. A Delta Force guy died. And then they tortured this 15-year-old boy into confessing to a ridiculous story that couldn't possibly be true about him throwing a grenade and killing this guy that their own Delta Force witnesses on scene debunk even the possibility that this could have even happened. But then, I'm sorry, Dennis, at the hard break there, I was asking whether there's any conceivable circumstance where that would be a war crime, even if it was true.
Well, of course. Had Omar been guilty of throwing a hand grenade on a battlefield, at the age of 15, he was entitled to many international instruments or treaties that the United States and Canada have been are signatories to. And one is, of course, the signatory on being a child soldier. But he was never treated as a child soldier, even though he was 15 at the time. And even though David Crane, who was the U.S. special prosecutor on the Sierra Leone child soldier trials that were funded both by Canada and the United States in the millions of dollars, agreed that he was a child soldier, Canada and the United States were firm in the fact that they would not allow him to be thought of as a child soldier. You also have other instruments. Like
Wait, when you say instruments, you mean protections. In other words, he's banned from being prosecuted for a war crime in a situation like that.
Yes, we give an international law. We have a different standard for children as opposed to adults. And so we have these various treaties that allow protection to our children. And the one is in particular countries where we have child soldiers that are put in these positions by authority figures, we give them protection. And we recognize that these are vulnerable individuals who, if we're fully informed and dispassionate, would not be in those battlefields. And so Canada and also the United States, in dealing with the child soldiers in Sierra Leone, spent millions to rehabilitate child soldiers. And yet, Omar Khadr was not recognized as a child soldier. In fact, no international treaty was allowed to be provided to Omar Khadr in Guantanamo Bay, just as no Canadian consular official under the Consular Relations Act was allowed to come and visit Omar in Guantanamo Bay and provide assistance. And so Guantanamo Bay is well described as a place beyond the rule of law.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, well, and before we get to Guantanamo, I wanted to get back to Bagram. In the documentary, You Don't Like the Truth, there's an interview with a guy, a gigantic prison guard-looking guy with monster tattooed across his chest, talking about how admitting that he was the meanest torturer there. But during his shift, no one was allowed to mess with this kid because he's just a kid. So leave him alone. But then I believe he also goes on to say, but hey, that was only when I was on duty. When I wasn't on duty, there was a lot more going on. And we're not talking about, I guess, the top secret, highest level rendition program. We're talking about basically just regular prison guards and lower level enlistees in the army, military police and such, being told, go ahead and do whatever you want to these guys with no limit. And so it's kind of maybe hard in 2015 for people to think about the climate as it was back then and what was being taken out on the prisoners in Bagram in 2001 and 2002. But could you, at the risk of grossing everyone out, could you please elaborate on what exactly they did to Omar Khadr?
Well, I think you're talking about Damian Cassetti, first of all. And Damian Cassetti has reached out for forgiveness from Omar Khadr. Damian Cassetti will tell you that he was 20 years of age when he was on this torture team, supervised by Sergeant Quaz. And he also says publicly that he was, he said, we did terrible things to that young man. And so you have to understand that despite the fact that what we're talking about is a hospital, and despite the fact he was in the hospital, and despite the fact that this 15-year-old had just regained consciousness and was suffering from extensive shrapnel wounds all over his body, that his that the bones in his left shoulder and chest were shattered from bullet wounds, or that he was now partially blind. He would be taken into an interrogation room with his hands and feet shackled to a stretcher, and leaving him to unable to resist the horrors that was going to be perpetrated on him by these torture individuals, this team. You know, and when the interrogators didn't like the answers they were given about Omar, they would put this man who's just come off the battlefield, gained consciousness 3 days later with all the sufferings I've just pointed out to you, and they would force him into stress positions, which is unnatural positions that would cause agonizing pain to this young boy. He would just end up screaming and sobbing. And when he reached that stage, while he's lying on his stretcher, it was then that his captors would then shine a bright pencil light directly into his damaged eyes, causing even more pain and even more damage. And when I referred that to, confronted Damien about that, that's when he said, you know, we did terrible things to that boy. And then as Omar became more mobile in the hospital, he would then be taken into the interrogation room with a black hood placed over his head, but the sole purpose of disorienting him. And what Omar describes, that he had this suffocating feeling as the hood was wrapped so tightly around his neck, nearly choking him. And so he panicked, this young boy, and he screamed to his interrogators that he couldn't breathe. And what would they do? They just laughed at him as they brought in barking dogs smiling into his face while he's covered with this hood. But, you know, probably more significant for me is the fact that and it was a constant punishment, it was a constant technique, that he would be made, this young boy, this young innocent boy, because I'm a father, that he would be made to stand on his toes in a crucifixion position for hours at a time, with his arms outstretched to the upper parts of a door jamb and hung by his wrist. And what happens is that eventually your weight, supporting your weight on your toes becomes an unbearable strain. And so your ankles and your feet will swell to at least twice their size, and you're in agonizing pain. And it was in those positions that Omar at times would then just urinate on himself. And they would then untie him, and they would use his head as a mop to clear up the urine on the floor. And while doing that, he would be threatened with rape and other humiliating acts, which I don't care to describe to you listeners. And there is support for that because in Guantanamo, at the so-called trial, a former U.S. Army medic gave evidence that he once found Omar chained to the doorframe of a 5-foot-square wire cage with his arms suspended, hooded, and weeping. So imagine that frightening picture of a 15-year-old boy. Imagine your own child, your own brother and sister being treated that way. And you know, I interviewed a British Guantanamo detainee, former British Guantanamo detainee in London, and he said, you know, we could hear Omar's cries and moans day and night until we separated from him. And we all felt bad for him. He was just so young. And here's another story for your listeners. I recall Omar telling me, because I drafted an affidavit for the Supreme Court of Canada, and I recall him telling me about the story of a U.S. soldier who would come to his bedside regularly, would drop his pants and stick his naked bum in Omar's face and then fart. And others around the bed would simply laugh at this antic. And so it's sickening, it's horrible. And what does it say about humanity?
All right, now I'm sorry. We have a very short time left. We got to move on to the bogus plea deal he was forced to accept. And then, you know, obviously the result is he was transferred to Canada, where now he's in, I believe, a regular prison, and there's a move to get him finally released. So in very little time, can you please address the bogus plea and the efforts to get him released?
Well, we don't have enough time. And Guantanamo, the story, the quality of representation that Omar received in Guantanamo was disgraceful. There were some great military lawyers who represented other detainees. Omar was not represented well. He had very inexperienced military lawyers, and it was very difficult for us civilian lawyers to be allowed to participate. no witnesses were called on his behalf or allowed in for his trial. I had everybody from the UN to David Crane from the Sierra Leone trials and so on and so forth, whom I was told would come as witnesses, were not allowed. And the, no self-defense was allowed, and no torture at, stories or evidence was allowed to be was accepted by the court. And so at some point, we received an offer. An offer that if he pled guilty to all these charges and all, and this statement of fact, that he could get out of Guantanamo, he'd get a sentence of 8 years with only 1 year to remain in Guantanamo and the 7 years back in Canada. And so Omar didn't want that deal. He wouldn't take that deal. And against all my training, I forced him because I told him if you don't sign this deal, you'll spend your life in this horrible place. And so he did so, and then he was returned to Canada. But the Canadian government took an extra year before it came to allow him to come home, contrary to the agreement. And on a, unfairly, the U.S. Pentagon in providing status about Omar Carr told the Canadian government in writing, which I provided to them, that Omar was a compliant minimum security prisoner and a former judge advocate from Guantanamo also wrote a letter saying he's just a nice kid. But the Canadian government refused to listen to that. They classified him as a maximum security prisoner, a danger to Canada, and a danger to any prisoner in any Canadian prison. And so he ended up in a maximum security prison in outside Ottawa, spent the first 7.5 months in isolation, and then on the day that he was released, he was put on a food line to assist, and somebody tried to stab him. I then was able to have him moved to another maximum security prison near my where I live. And what did we do on arrival? We put him on this Muslim kid, we put him on a white supremacist unit, and the shit was kicked out of him all within 5 minutes. And so welcome to Canada. And so I have not lost a single case against this government in over 10 years in fighting for Omar Carter. I was also successful, along with others, in the U.S. Supreme Court. But I'm also confronted with the limits of justice. When you're facing governments who are intractable and determined to do what they wish to do. And so Omar Carr continues to remain in jail, and so I keep coming up with different ideas of trying to get him out. I'm back in the Supreme Court in May, and I'm also for the third time in Canada on Omar Carr, but more importantly, I'm doing a bail hearing, which is quite unique. And that bail hearing requires, if I'm successful, a plan, a reorientation plan into society. And I have all kinds, and so on the public record, all kinds of established public figures who are prepared to step up and assist Omar in his reintegration back into society. Because they, like many of us, believe that what happened to Omar Carter is a horror story, and not just for them, but for any of our children. Because whatever happened to Omar could happen to any of our children, any of us. So we bequeathed a terrible legacy for their future.
Well, listen, this is such an important thing, and he is so lucky that he's got a lawyer who knows what he's doing and willing to work so hard on this. So I want to encourage everybody, if you can, please go to freeomar.ca. That's how to donate to this cause, correct? Correct, sir, Dennis?
Yes,
I just want to make sure I wasn't giving everybody the wrong URL all of a sudden there. freeomar.ca. Listen, I've kept you over time, but thank you so much for giving us this time of yours this afternoon to talk with us about this absolutely horrible case.
No, thank you, and thank you, listeners, for being interested.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks again. Talk to you
Bye-bye.
Another time soon, I hope.
Bye.
All right, y'all, that's Dennis Edney. The website is freeomar.ca if you want to help this campaign to, he's taking it to the Canadian Supreme Court to try to get Omar Carter, this innocent victim of the terror war, released from prison. Right back in a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, well, I screwed that up and went into the break there, of course. Great interview, huh? Good lawyer there. Hey, if you're one of those guys with a pile of money that usually you like it to be, you know, capital to invest in future production, there's also charity. And how would you like it if you were Omar Khadr? So, I don't know, help his lawyer take this thing to the Supreme Court. That's what he said at the end. He's fighting this thing in the Supreme Court. He said he's already put together, he's got like a PR campaign, and he's put together prominent Canadian citizens to pledge to work to help Omar Khadr on his release and get him a house and a job and a therapist. Unreal, that story. God, I can't get over it. Hey, here's some good news just off the top of my Twitter coming in here. They figured out that if you mix aluminum with iron, then it doesn't really work that well. But if you add nickel, blam. These are B2 intermetallic compounds, you understand. And all of a sudden, the nickel reacts with some of the aluminum to create B2 crystals a few nanometers across. These crystals form both between and within the steel's grains when it is annealed, a form of heat treatment. And anyway, point of the thing is this. According to the headline, an alloy of iron and aluminum and nickel is as strong as titanium at a tenth of the cost. Blam, right here, wave of the future. Isn't that cool? What a man can accomplish with a brain and a Macintosh. I assume they probably don't run PC piece of crap like I got. Anyway, yeah, man, cool. So they're talking about all the drawbacks of the weight of steel and how this overcomes that problem in a great many ways. Let's think of all the engineers who, once they find this, I'm like the 13th person to retweet it. 12th or 13th. Just wait till every genius, every real ass engineer in the world hears about this. That's cool, right? Seems like it's going to be a big deal. Invest now while you can. I mean, assuming what they say is true, really. All right, news. Man. I'm going to talk about this more. Oh, by the way, Mike Meharry coming up from the 10th Amendment Center, so stay tuned. Even if you don't like listening to me, he's going to say things that you'll want to hear probably. Okay, Libya stories. That's the top of my notes. Oh, the website again is freeomar.ca to try to help Omar Khadr there. Freeomar.ca. And the documentary is You Don't Like the Truth. Go watch it. It's at scotthorton.org/documentaries. It's unreal. Think about that while you're pulling the lever for Jeb Bush. Freeomar.ca. Freeomar.ca. Okay. No, Libya stories. I cannot get over this Libya thing. And I don't want you to get over it. I want to make sure. See, here's the problem. I told you what the problem was. And I'm seeing the problem is still a problem. The problem is, everybody who is anti-Hillary, not everybody, other than us libertarians, everyone who's anti-Hillary is a right-winger of some kind or another. And they're virtually all a bunch of sick, blood-drinking warmongers who just can't get enough violence ever to satiate their internal thirst. And so, they don't really care if Hillary Clinton turned Libya into a giant hellhole of war and all that, because they agreed with her at the time. And they don't want to hold themselves accountable for going along with her. And the liberals don't want to make a big deal out of it because she's their duchess of inheriting the divine right of the presidency coming up here. Her turn. You understand, that ain't my quote. And so only libertarians have a real incentive to attack her for this, or I guess Jim Webb partisans on the left. Do we have any of those? So it's on us. But you got to read these. And if you haven't read them yet, read them. If you knew, because, Scott, you already said this. I know, but did you actually read them? And then if you did read them, did you pass them around on your Facebook there? Did you do what you could to make this a viral thing? Because this is a huge, mongous thing, okay? You got Denis Kucinich, and you got the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. With or without the permission of the president? With or without the permission of Secretary Gates? I don't know. Working to stop Hillary Clinton's war on Libya in 2011. And completely throwing her under the bus in a major way, which is sort of a side issue that, like, wow, isn't that great to find out how many people in the Pentagon are willing to leak this story to the Washington Times to try to hurt her? Guess it didn't work, her first trial run as commander-in-chief there, that well. But anyway, you have them complaining outright and with quotes and saying, hey, we knew that there was no genocide, that the casus belli was a big lie. We knew that Gaddafi was not going to murder every man, woman, and child in Benghazi, as Hillary Clinton claimed was about to happen. And they knew that the rebels that were siding with, who is it? There ain't no moderates around. Who is fighting to overthrow Gaddafi? The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. Who's that? Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's who it is. Al-Qaeda in Iraq after they got back home to Libya. George W. Bush gave them an 8-year battlefield. Well, longer now. Call it 12. He created Sunni Jihadistan in the land from Fallujah up to Mosul there. And so these Libyan extremists, they went and joined up Zarqawi and practiced killing Americans, and then they came home, and Hillary and Obama and the Republican Party took their side, and the Democratic Party too, mostly, took their side in their war against the secular, whiskerless, that is, clean-shaven, socialist, atheist Muammar Gaddafi. Not that I'm a big pro-socialist guy, but really, you're going to overthrow another basically Ba'athist in favor of jihadists? Right after Iraq, you're going to do that again? Well, there were a lot of people who were saying the very same things. And now that it's 4 years later, they're ratting on Hillary Clinton bad. 3-part series in the Washington Times. Secret tapes undermine Hillary Clinton on Libya war. Hillary Clinton's WMD moment. U.S. intelligence saw false narrative in Libya. And secret Benghazi report reveals Hillary's Libya war push armed Al-Qaeda-tied terrorists. And they knew it. Isn't that crazy? Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense, said, don't choose this war of choice, Mr. President. That's my advice. And he chose it. Damn. What promises did he make to Hillary to keep her out of the U.S. Senate this whole time? You know? God dang. What was he doing? And then the war accidentally spread to Mali. Because what happened was the Tuareg mercenaries who worked for Gaddafi and lost at the hands of NATO and the Mujahideen, they took their weapons and fled home to Mali. And then they said, wow, we got all these weapons. Why settle for autonomy from southern Mali, who rules us, when we could declare independence? So they declared independence and fought a war of independence, which is fine by me, except what happened was then their jihadi enemies followed them into Mali and marginalized them and hijacked their revolution and marched all the way down to the south, which became the excuse for a French intervention. Thank God Obama didn't invade Mali that time. Hillary was begging the Algerians to do it for him. Oops, made a mess there. And then, of course, as we all know, there was a, and it is proven over and over, they were sending jihadis and guns onto Syria for that war, that Mujahideen war against another whiskerless, secular, atheist, fascist in favor of the suicide bombers, the Bin Ladenites. Hey, Al Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, so it's the confirmation hearings in the Senate for Ashton Carter, sure to be confirmed as the new Secretary of Defense. And I'm trying to get somebody on from RightWeb to talk about him because they got the best bio on him, of course. You know, RightWeb is a real cool project. It's, I think, the Institute for Policy Studies. And I don't know, man. If, you know, it's some kind of liberal think tank type, but they're pretty damn good. But RightWeb, it's cool how they don't write about every kind of damn Republican, you know, any sort of conservative or right-wing faction you can think of. They really just focus on the neocons, the so-called conservative foreign policy establishment, which is pretty much all neocons and their think tanks. So it's not too broad of a brush at all. You know what I mean? It's, hey, you want to know who the neocons are? Spend an hour and a half looking at RightWeb. You'll say to yourself, my God, man. It's all very much in the spirit of Jim Loeb. And Tom Barry, I think, wrote a lot of that stuff back when. I don't know whatever happened to Tom Barry. He used to write some good stuff, dude. Anyway, it's one of the things that liberal internationalists are good for, and that is being good on neoconservatives. Yeah. Okay. They're against a lot of good, a lot of terrible stuff. Not so much in agreement with whatever they're for, but who cares? Nobody listens to them anyway. All right. Yeah, it's my show. I did the Libya thing. Let me switch to, I guess I'll carry on from there. So, they backed the Mujahideen. Ridiculously, unbelievably. Go back and check the archives from this show at the time, all through 2011. We covered it. Patrick Coburn told you so. It was in the damn Telegraph. Yeah, this rebel leader says, yeah, we're veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, but don't worry, it's cool. We appreciate your help. okay, well, thanks. That's all we really want is to feel needed. So, happy to be of service. And then, next thing you know, Mujahideen and guns off to go and fight in Syria. And that was, you got to give them credit. Fox News has done some actual journalism. Never mind their talking head anchors or whatever. You go look at their website. They've done some actual journalism with some actual sources about covert operations involving guns and Mujahideen. And same thing for the Sunday Times, which is the British paper version of Fox News. And they've got, man, they had one back then where the ship landed at the port in Turkey. And they're going to ship all the guns, and it was the Muslim Brotherhood. I guess they still existed back then. The Muslim Brotherhood in Syria. They've been subsumed. But it was them and other Mujahideen types fighting over who's supposed to get the guns and all that. And that's a big part of what the CIA and the State Department were doing in Benghazi at the time that the ambassador was killed. That's been a kind of a pet peeve of mine, although I try not to care about it that much because I don't care about it that much. But it's a little kind of funny sort of an anecdote that the entire, you know, Fox News, Washington Times, Republican Party, Rush Limbaugh type consensus is, oh my God, Benghazi is the worst scandal ever. And yet they only speak of it in terms entirely divorced from the rest of the war and what else was going on. Now, what was going on was America was inexplicably backing the Sunni-based insurgency. They just finished fighting in Iraq.
Washington Times now, 4 years later, says, holy crap, this is how we got into this mess. And then, of course, by backing the Civil War, they created the space for ISIS. And ISIS, you know, I don't know. If anybody has a real good footnote to contradict me, I'd be happy to hear it. I don't know of any good information that says that America's directly arming and backing and deliberately supporting ISIS or its rise. But then again, ISIS is just a split off from al-Nusra, who are the same damn thing, al-Qaeda in Iraq, just a personality conflict there. And, well, goals, but otherwise they got everything in common. And they've known all along that it's al-Nusra who are the leaders of the insurgency over there and always have been ever since 2011. Very early 2012, the White House or the State Department put al-Nusra on the terrorist list. But they dominated the field by super majorities, you know, always did from the very beginning. And so by insisting that Assad must step down and that no rebel faction at all should ever have to deal with a Ba'athist government with Assad at the head of it in Damascus, and by continuing to coordinate with the Qataris, the Turks, and the Saudis to send more money and more guns to the Mujahideen, it's not even 1 degree of separation, right? It's a tenth of a degree of separation. It's not plausible deniability for, it's two-thirds, it's one-third plausible deniability or one-quarter plausible deniability for America directly aiding and abetting the rise of ISIS. I mean, this is what they've done. It's hard to even describe it without just sounding like a nut. Yeah, America backs ISIS. Well, it's just not quite like that. But they sure didn't tell the Saudis to stop backing Arar al-Sham, which is ISIS now. And, you know, and they sure didn't discourage the Turks in any real way from backing al-Nusra, even after the Turks and al-Nusra tried to frame Assad in the poison gas plot in the summer of 2013. To lie us into war. As Dennis Kucinich said then, just like in Libya. Good try, Dennis, there on Libya, man. Just like in Libya, Obama wants us to be Al-Qaeda's Air Force. Are you crazy? And then luckily, as Ray McGovern explained yesterday on the show, at least the Russians saved us from that one and gave Obama a face-saving way out by getting Assad to get rid of his chemical weapons. But man... And anyway, so that's, you know, a big part of the story of the rise of ISIS. And then the latest news, of course, is, as I talked about at the beginning of the show yesterday, the ISIS guys executed by fire in a cage. The Jordanian pilot, great PR stunt, guys. Well, so then the Jordanians have fought back by executing two or three. I saw different reports of their ISIS prisoners. And so then the question is, you know, whether the Jordanians are going to get further into this war now and this, that, the other thing. And I guess it's likely. I don't know. They've got one of the best militaries in the region, trained and armed and equipped by the Americans and the Israelis for a long time. So I guess we'll see what happens there. And really, I think they believe this. Honestly, I hear these completely ridiculous people say this, and there doesn't seem to be any kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge going on or anything. They just sort of believe, I think, that, you know, by having Jordan and Saudi Arabia as our allies in this, that proves how totally pro-Sunni we are and how we're hardly taking the side of Iran and their sock puppets in Iraq against you or anything like that, because look at all the legitimacy we bring with us by lying with the Hashemite kingdom in Jordan and King who's it's now for the next few years, they say maybe has Alzheimer's in Saudi, but they're not the Hashemites, right? The Saudis, the Hashemites lost out to the Saudi family, am I right? That was back when, I don't know. Anyway. Oh, man, I had more stuff to complain about. But next, Mike Meharry from the 10th Amendment Center. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. On the line, I got Mike Meharry from the 10th Amendment Center and also offnow.org. We'll get to the offnow stuff here in a minute, but first, better do it that way. I got this great email the other day. I almost can't believe it. Mike, states considering more than 200 bills to block federal power. You know what, my man? I don't care if you are defining that broadly. Go ahead and define it and tell me what all you're talking about. Give me 200 examples or as many as you want. Welcome to the show. Good to talk to you again.
Hey, Scott. It's good to be on. Yeah, 200-plus bills. Isn't that crazy?
That's so great. What are we talking about here?
You know, just to give people perspective, you know, just 3 years ago, I was able to pretty much keep up with every nullification type bill that was introduced in any state legislature. You know, I could say, oh, Arizona's got this going on and Vermont's got this going on. I can't do that anymore, obviously. I mean, it's just amazing how much this has grown. And we're talking about bills that run the gamut. I mean, we've got legislation that would end state cooperation in implementing or running Obamacare. We've got bills that would deny any material resources to the NSA. We've got bills that would prohibit the state agency from cooperating with anything that violates the Second Amendment. We've got these right to try laws, which basically allow people in a state that are considered terminally ill to try experimental medications, even though the FDA hasn't approved them, basically saying, screw you, FDA, we're going to let people in our state have access to these treatments if they want them. You know, we've got the continuing push to legalize marijuana, both recreationally and for medicinal purposes. We've got NDAA detention bills where states won't cooperate with federal kidnapping. I mean, the list just goes on and on. It's a broad range of subjects, but all with the same basic premise that the state is saying, we're not going to cooperate with you, federal government. We're going to do everything in our power to make sure that you can't carry out these actions within our state. Mm-hmm.
And I know one of the things on the list there, too, and I saw a great write-up about this the other day, I think at rare.com maybe, about top five ways that states are pushing back against the militarization of the police and basically attempting to nullify the 1033 program. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, and, you know, those bills that we're seeing introduced, basically what they do is they either put severe limits or outright bans on the procurement of military equipment through these programs. I think there's four or five states that have introduced this type of legislation. And some of them are broader than others, but all of them are basically, you know, the same thing. They disallow the local law enforcement from getting machine guns and tanks and these crazy things that Lord knows they don't really need. And this is, you know, basically you can look at it and say, well, you know, it's only operating on the state level. It's prohibiting the state and local law enforcement. Now, how is that really nullification? But here's the thing that people need to understand about the whole police militarization thing. This is a huge incentive for police departments to cooperate with the federal government in other ways. They love getting the toys. They love getting the asset forfeiture money. And when you start breaking down these incentives, then you're less likely to have the police lobbies pushing back when we try to say, hey, we don't want you enforcing these federal gun laws. Right now, every time that we try to pass these type of bills, the police lobbies come out and lobby against them because they don't want in these federal local partnerships. So basically, it's putting a wedge between the state and local law enforcement and the federal government, and that's a good thing because it de-incentivizes the police department and refocuses their attention on you know, doing what I guess they're supposed to do within the borders of their own state, not perpetuating a drug war or a war on terror or whatever war they've come up with this week.
Yeah, I want to see a ban on police lobbying anything. What the hell right do they have to insist on any particular policy? You know?
Yeah.
If they want to say we want to wear, you know, light brown shirts instead of blue, I guess that's within their purview. Otherwise, shut up and do your job.
Right.
Or
and
actually, better yet,
lobby.
Don't.
Like I said, it comes out any action to limit drones. Any action to limit cooperation with indefinite detention, any action to limit the cooperation with the NSA, any action to limit state cooperation with enforcing federal gun laws, police lobby always comes out strong. And unfortunately, a lot of legislators get all sweaty and nervous when the police lobby shows up because, you know, we all love our cops, I guess. So we need to do everything we can to try to limit and to, like I said, put a wedge between the local and state law enforcement and the federal government. Those things are not supposed to be connected. You know, the police departments aren't a standing army, and they shouldn't be viewed as such.
Right. Yeah. All right. So now, of course, and we got to talk about this, and it's important, I think, for listeners who, you know, they like one thing and they don't like the other, but the doctrine is important. And here we have, for example, supposed right-wing issues, although any good liberal, progressive, socialist, or anything else who read Marcy Wheeler would know better than to support Obamacare, I think. But anyway, you got a supposed right-wing issue like Obamacare, like guns, with supposed left-wing issues, although, you know, the militarization, that kind of cuts both ways.
Yeah, it really does.
Populist right-wingers oppose that as well. But the NSA, that kind of cuts both ways as well, NSA being a bipartisan issue. I guess we tend to think of legalizing pot as more of a left-wing issue. But then again, a hemp farmer is probably more likely to be a Republican. So, in other words, this is just about us. It's really much more a question of the people versus the centralized power. And I think people have noticed, of people of all stripes and ideologies and backgrounds, have noticed that the centralized power doesn't have the people's interests at heart. They only have the interests at heart. And if we can decentralize a little bit, then, you know, regular people can have a little bit more of a fair shake. It's not a magic cure. The government of Texas can be just as completely crazy and irrational and harsh as the national government. It's just a little bit easier to petition is all.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, at least if you've got 50 states that are operating in a more decentralized way, you know, at least you have some recourse if they get nutty in Texas. You always have the opportunity to move to a state that's less nutty. So, you know, kind of create some competition in that old, what do they call it, the laboratory of ideas. When you have a centralized power, you know, dictating everything for 350 plus million people. Well, you know, I don't have much of a way to get away from it. I guess I can try to go to Canada or something, but, you know, the IRS is still going to tax me. So I think decentralization is a key. People want liberty. The first step is decentralization.
There's one we need to see. Nullification of the IRS. Hey, Amendment 5 seems to preclude the idea of something like this. And so your powers are null and void in our state.
You know, that one of the things that has come up, and I don't really think that the legislative will is there for this kind of thing quite yet, but, you know, if this movement keeps growing, maybe it will be, but it's the idea that the state will start collecting federal taxes and holding them in escrow and then giving the federal government the amount of money necessary to do what its actual enumerated powers are, and then the rest of it would go back to the people. So that would be really a way of nullifying the IRS in a way, you know, basically giving the state control and saying, hey, we're not going to give you tax money to do things that you're not authorized to do.
Yeah. All right. Good times. Hey, more with Mike Meharry from the 10th Amendment Center. Especially, we're going to focus on the NSA in Utah and, well, a lot of other things too, man. Good stuff. Mike Meharry from the 10th Amendment Center and offnow.org. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at Darren'sCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Mike Meharry from the 10th Amendment Center. You know the Bill of Rights, right? Yeah, that's the one that says, just in case you want to try to misinterpret anything in the previous articles here, you only have the powers expressly delegated to your national government. The rest belong to the states and to the people. And so, like all laws, it's not really the law unless people make it the law in practice. And that's what Mike Meharry and the guys at the 10th Amendment Center do. They're trying to bring this long lamentedly lost amendment back to life here and try to put the national government a little bit, well, toward back in its place anyway. Won't be finished till the dollar breaks, Mike, but you guys are doing a great job of, and I think, you know, this couldn't possibly be overstated, really. It's all about just getting the word out that, yeah, nullification. What? Like, supposedly, somehow before, that was a politically incorrect thing to say or you know, some kind of thing. But even on, you know, political, on local and state levels, the political class is open to this idea. You know, geez, we are kind of tired of paying for this and that. Maybe we could do it a different way. And, you know, thankfully, the lack of respect for the national government at this point, kind of, there's an atmosphere where, yeah, why not? Let's just go ahead and challenge them. And you know, especially then as we're talking about where you have sometimes it's gun laws, sometimes it's pot laws that are being nullified. It creates this much kind of sort of better atmosphere, I guess, for people to understand the issue in that, it, you know. As I was already saying, I guess, I'm sorry, I'm just repeating myself. I'm just really excited, and I'm excited for you because I think that you guys deserve a ton of credit for really, you know, pushing this as a popular topic, getting people in state capitals all around the country interested in accentuating their own power and authority at the expense of the national government, if that's what it takes. Like in Federalist Number 10, ambition must be made to counteract ambition, so... That's my rant. Thanks.
That was an excellent rant. And I think you hit a good point. You know, there is that level of disgust. And some of these things are a slam dunk. You know, when you start talking about, I mentioned the right to trial a few minutes ago. You know, when you have federal bureaucrats telling a sick person, hey, you can't have this treatment because we haven't undone the bureaucratic red tape yet. I don't care whether you're a lefty or a righty or in the middle or what political persuasion you might be from. Anybody can look at that and go, that's dumb. And so there is that disgust. Why should the FDA deny people treatments that could possibly save their lives when they're going to die anyway, you know, just because they want to have people jump through their hoops? And when you have those type of things, when you have that type of overreach that is so glaring, it really does raise the disgust level, and I think that's part of why you're seeing this movement grow. People see those kind of things, and they start to look at other things and say, you know what? There's a lot of things the federal government's sticking their nose into that they shouldn't be.
Yep. All right, now hit them real hard with the latest from Utah.
Well, we're excited about what's going on in Utah. You know, we had the interim committee hearing back in November, and that went real well, and it was very clear, you know, the room was packed, and it was very clear that there's a lot of support for turning off the water to the NSA facility in Bluffdale, Utah. And the sponsor of that bill, Mark Roberts, he's reintroduced the bill. He's cleaned up the language a little bit, and he seems to feel like it's got a good shot at getting a committee hearing and moving forward. And we cleared one little political hurdle just last week. They have these things called fiscal notes that they put on bills, and basically it's an analysis of how much a bill will cost, you know, how much it'll cost the state government, how much revenue they could lose if they pass it into law, et cetera. And sometimes these things are used to kill bills. You know, they'll stick a huge fiscal note on it and say, oh, this bill is going to cost $100 billion to implement. And so that kills the bill without even any debate. And the fiscal note that was put onto the Utah turn off the water bill basically said it's not going to cost the state any money. It's not going to cost city governments any money. And that's a good thing. It takes away that that argument and that little way of killing a bill. So, you know, nice little political hurdle that's been cleared, and now we're just gearing up for a committee hearing.
Right on. And now, so what about the discussion in Utah? Because that's where the national government happened to choose to put it. It's sort of up to them. Does it seem like the people slash and or the political class really have much momentum one way or the other on this?
Well, I think there is. I think a lot of people have, you know, I think there's a lot of awareness that what the NSA doing is way out of bounds. You know, we can thank Edward Snowden for that, and the media that's done its digging in the wake of all the revelations. So I think there's a pretty strong basis of, you know, the NSA shouldn't be doing this stuff. And when it comes to Utah, I think a lot of people that are there, you know, are kind of like, why are we helping them do this? Especially when they found out that the NSA got a really good water deal and is basically paying less than the average resident is to get the water. So yeah, I think there's momentum. I think there's a lot of popular support for this idea. I think the pushback is going to come from people who view the NSA as an economic, you know, engine, and they're excited that it's there because it's going to create jobs or whatever kind of economic crap that they think it's going to bring. And you know, that's pretty easy to defeat. You know, you're not going to give up your rights to make a few bucks if you have any sense. So I think that the popular opinion on the ground is strong. I think there's a lot of legislators who, you know, judging from the interim committee hearing, there's a lot of support for the idea. We've virtually eliminated, you know, here when we first brought this up last year, we started talking about turning off the water. There was a lot of, you can't do that. And we've completely eliminated that. Nobody is questioning whether or not this is a viable thing to do. The really only question left is, are we going to support the NSA in Utah or not? The whole argument about whether it's legal or about whether it's feasible or any of that stuff has all been pretty much wiped away. And that's a huge advance in the argument, and so now basically we just got to get these folks to go on record and say, hey, we either support you being spied on or we don't.
Right. Okay. Now, so what about all the liberal college professors listening, saying, "Nuh-uh," because the supremacy clause?
Well, you know, hopefully, even the liberal. Legal professors know about the anti-commandeering doctrine, and they know that the Supreme Court has held since 1842 that the federal government cannot force states to provide resources or manpower or anything else to advance a federal program or to, you know, carry out a federal edict. This is well established, and that's all these NSA bills are, saying the state is not going to provide material support. And that's well established. The federal government, you know, if the NSA can, if they want to carry buckets of water up there and cool their towers, they're welcome to do it. But the state's not going to help. And this is well established. And, you know, a few years ago, they tried to put a nuclear waste dump on Yucca Mountain in Nevada. And Nevada basically followed this exact same strategy. You know, the Environmental Protection Agency bent a bunch of rules for the for the Energy Department so they could put this nuclear waste facility on what was essentially unstable ground. And Utah's like, we don't want this. And Congress said, you're going to get it anyway. So when they started to try to build the thing, the Utah government said, we're not going to give you these water permits. We're going to deny the permits for you to even have the water to build this thing and do the drilling that's necessary. And it went to court, and the federal court actually found in favor with the state of Nevada. They said, you know what? It's Nevada's water. We can't make them give it up. And so eventually that whole waste dump was abandoned by the Obama administration because the state was willing to push back. So we know this will work, and we know that it's already been tried and it's been legitimized. So, you know, all of these arguments just fall away. Again, the question that anybody has to ask themselves is, do you support your government spying on you or not? And if you don't support it, then you should support turning off the water. And if you're for spying, then go on record and say it, and then let the people decide whether they want you to remain in office or not.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Man, that is so great. It's I almost can't believe it, but I know you, and you're telling it to me, so I believe you. But otherwise, it's unbelievable.
It is. Well, it's almost unbelievable to us. You know, we started seeing all these bills rolling in, and you know, if you go to our blog at the 10th Amendment Center, at 10thamendmentcenter.com, you can just go through and look at all the bill reports that are on there, and it's like, oh, my gosh, you know, we're putting dozens of these up every day, and people are just cranking these reports out, and
awesome.
It's amazing.
All right.
Very exciting.
That's the 10th Amendment Center and offnow.org, 10thamendmentcenter.com, and offnow.org. Mike Meharry, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott, as always.
All right, see y'all tomorrow.